From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the nationwide nursing shortage and how it's impacting hospitals in Wisconsin. Then we'll learn about MATC's new Gap Year program that aims to help recent grads figure out the next steps ahead after high school.
It really is to try to jumpstart that career planning, but do so in a fun, experiential way. It's not as costly as starting in a class and not knowing if that's your route. It's okay to take a step back and figure out what's next.
Plus, a new documentary tells the story of a fighter pilot downed over Italy and his family finding the crash site 70 years later.
The relationships that we have now that we will have for generations to come, I think really truly embodies the meaning and spirit of finding Warren.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. It's been a rough couple years for medical professionals. They've been putting their lives at risk to help our communities survive during the pandemic, and many of them are feeling the physical and emotional toll. For nurses, it's been especially difficult. Nursing shortages caused by increased competition for employees, fewer people entering the field, and people quitting or retiring have meant that the nurses who remain are working even harder to make sure hospitals can keep running. Mary Beth Kingston is all too familiar with how much hospitals depend on the work of nurses. She's the chief nursing officer for Advocate Aurora Health, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
We have a shortage of nurses right now in Wisconsin, and that can have a huge impact on our healthcare systems. Just for reference, what are some of the things nurses take care of at a hospital?
Oh, boy. First of all, I have to say we have a shortage of nurses throughout the country right now. So this is, it's greater than Wisconsin. Nurses to me are really the glue that holds the healthcare system together. I mean, we're in hospitals, which is, I think, where people are very familiar with seeing nurses, but we're also in clinics, all of the clinic settings. We're in people's homes. We're in the community, running support groups, helping new moms at home. So we're really in every aspect and setting where you would see healthcare being delivered.
You mentioned this is a nationwide shortage. It's also something that we've been dealing with for a number of years. This isn't something that just popped up during the pandemic. What has been happening at hospitals, specifically your hospital, as a result of not enough nurses necessarily to do the work?
Well, I've been a nurse for 44 years, so you're right. We've had nursing shortages. We have peaks and valleys, and many times we've been able to really get that supply and demand right where it needs to be. And I would say the years prior to the pandemic, actually, we were doing quite well. A lot of people very interested in nursing careers. We're looking for diverse candidates. We're partnering with schools, so that's been wonderful. But the pandemic really did challenge all of us and highlight a number of issues I think that we have to address. So number one, right now what we're seeing is just kind of the perfect storm of things coming together. We, in the beginning of the pandemic, we rallied. People were helping from all different areas. The community was there. And then as time has worn on, the exhaustion has set in. And certainly we also needed to get back to the business of caring for patients. And then we continue to have these surges, and we're obviously in the midst of another surge now. So that impacts nurses tremendously. And those that are on the cusp of maybe retiring say, well, you know what, I maybe this is the right time for me to do that. Another thing that's happened, so there's all of these factors at play, is because of the nationwide shortage, travel agencies, nurses going to travel to different locations, they have really increased their salaries tremendously, making it extremely attractive for people to really leave their families and go to, and certainly if you have the ability to do that, but go to some of the travel nursing organizations and work in other places. So we, as in many places across the country, have seen some loss there as well. The other thing is the workforce, it's the workplace itself. As leaders, we really need to focus on making this an environment that's supportive, that people want to be in, And we have, again, across the country, had issues with workplace violence at times. And we've seen that increase a bit during the pandemic, where there might be folks who don't want a mask, or they, you know, don't want to follow some of the rules, regulations. And we've also had to restrict visiting, which has caused tremendous distress for our nurses, and specifically for our patients and their families. So there's lots of factors that are playing into this right now.
You mentioned just the exhaustion, and you just said the job is, it doesn't get easier when there are fewer people to do it. And the pandemic has resulted in a lot of emotions among people who have lost loved ones, who can't be with their loved ones, or people who don't really believe that the pandemic has been as difficult as it has been. How are you as a system dealing with the kind of trauma that many nurses are experiencing?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, initially we focused on the immediate need. So we jumped into action. We had a family care stipend that covered childcare where children weren't in school. We looked at folks that were having financial difficulty and said, you can cash in, double your PTO. So we put hotels if you don't want to go home, really supporting kind of the basic needs. We also have a support fund for our team members, and we spent, I think, almost $2 million at this point from that if people are having issues. But as you mentioned, now we're moving into a little bit of a different phase where it's longer term. And yes, financial incentives and compensation are great, but that's a short-term thing. And we really do have to address the stress and trauma that people are experiencing. So another thing that we work on, it sounds very simple, but it's really important, is helping people to connect to their purpose. And the purpose of, you know, people go into healthcare because they want to help people. And how do we continue to focus on that? Again, that's one strategy. So we do daily messaging, provide information in huddles for leaders. Another thing that I think is really important, when I talk to nurses all the time, and we have, as many places do, we have a structure called shared governance, where nurses meet and they make decisions about their practice. And I and other leaders work with those nurses. And we often ask them, what would you find helpful? Because I can sit and think of a million things that might be helpful that might not really impact folks who are providing care. And they often say that they get their greatest source of support from their coworkers. And so we have a very robust, and it's really for everyone in our system, but a peer-to-peer support program called Together as One, where we have volunteers, and they come from all different disciplines, and they go through some additional training. But then they're back there in the work setting, and they have additional training to help identify when someone is struggling, or to help people get to the various. We have so many strategies in place. But when you're busy and taking care of patients, you're not often thinking, oh, yes, I'm going to call employee assistance, or, you know, I have a chaplain who I can reach 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You just are kind of getting through your shift. But if you have coworkers that are there, and a leader and a manager who's there really checking in on you and seeing how you're doing, then those individuals can then help connect people to the resources that we have available.
A lot of that speaks to retention, retaining nurses who are on staff. You mentioned previously that before the pandemic, there were nursing shortages, but you had success with these programs that were getting people into the system, getting people into the places that you needed them. What is that work looking like right now?
Yeah, we're doing a number of different things. The one thing, again, when we ask our team members what is helpful, they often mention compensation as well. So that's something that we've taken a good hard look at and have definitely been reviewing and putting into place additional compensation strategies. That doesn't, you know, in sending people to work more when they're tired doesn't always work. It's not always a great strategy. But there are many folks that work part-time that might be interested. We have people in other areas, our clinics, for example, who have really stepped up and have been willing to help us as well. And then rewarding people who are precepting new graduates, for example, those very experienced nurses. So compensation is a piece of it. The other thing we've been very focused on now is looking at the work that's there and trying to back off and remove some things that aren't critical right now. And that doesn't sound like much, but if you're the manager and you're always, can you identify a nurse for this committee or that group? It's very important to have that nursing voice there, but this may not be the best time to have a lot of other additional activities when we're going through an additional surge. So our organization has been very supportive of continuing to focus on quality safety, but maybe pulling back a little bit from some of the meetings and those type of things that take time away from the bedside. Another thing that we've done, and I think other organizations have as well, is there is an opportunity to look at your electronic health record and how nurses document and tailor that during crisis situations, really begin to say, what are the essentials? And we implemented that during the other surges and now are again allowing each site to determine based on their needs, whether or not they need to do that. So focusing again on recognition, reward, whether it's compensation or other areas, but also really looking at the work that nurses are doing. The other thing I would add is that we have had a great partnership. Nursing has had a great partnership with our employee health services, our employee assistance services, and behavioral health. And so we've been able to identify appointments and support for people who are, you know, people get stressed and people get anxious. And then there are many people who are really having such a difficult time that they've got to seek additional help. And we've been able to provide those services as well.
All right. Well, Mary Beth, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
I'm delighted to be here. And many thanks to all the nurses at Advocate Aurora Health and throughout our country and certainly throughout Wisconsin.
Mary Beth Kingston is the Chief Nursing Officer for Advocate Aurora Health, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the nationwide nursing shortage. Before we continue with Lake Effect, I wanted to take a moment to ask for your support. We all know that important news breaks and comes at us at all hours of the day. Whether you hear it on Morning Edition or like the story you just heard from Lake Effect's Joy Powers on the nursing shortage, you know, the reporting work and resources behind everything you hear on WUWM must be fueled by the sustained energy of people who care, people like you. And even though we still face challenges, meeting them effectively and with hope for a better, more connected world means we have to be prepared with the information and ideas needed to move forward together. So this means that your continuing support is essential to all the rewarding moments you spend in the company of WUWM. Whether it's right now on Lake Effect or during Morning Edition or All Things Considered or even late at night, keeping you informed, engaged, inspired, and connected when you need it the most, that's our specialty. This is what your support does. So give now at wuwm.com/give, or you can call 877-583-0309. Or if you happen to be listening on our app right now or you have it open, just tap that red donate button on the app. We are especially looking for new members to join the WUWM family, but sustaining memberships or renewals or one-time gifts are equally important, and they all go towards supporting public radio right here in Milwaukee. Again, call 877-583-0309, wuwm.com/give. Coming up in about 13 minutes, we'll meet the director and producer of the documentary Finding Lauren, who took on the project in honor of her late husband and his father, who was killed in action during World War II.
And I read all 350 letters and the diary and everything, and then I compiled a timeline and then started using excerpts to create a script.
But first, we'll learn about a new program at MATC that hopes to guide recent high school graduates as they decide the next steps in their education. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Taking a gap year after high school was becoming more common for graduates even before the pandemic changed higher education. A new program at Milwaukee Area Technical College hopes to help those high school grads who choose to take a year off decide whether to go into college or launch into a career. The MATC Gap Year program was created in partnership with Milwaukee, and it's currently accepting applications for those who graduated high school during the pandemic in 2020 or 2021. It's a one-week paid opportunity where participants will get a taste of several career paths, meet local employers, and get advice on college options. WUWM education reporter Emily Files talked to MATC Vice President for Advancement Laura Bray and Milwaukee Chief Ideas Officer Jeremy Foyett about the Gap Year program. Bray begins by explaining where this idea came from.
We've worked with Milwaukee on other projects here at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and quite honestly, it was in March, or soon after the pandemic hit, actually. I think it was April of 2020. At that time, Jeremy gave a call and said, you know, I've been doing a lot of research on this instance where individuals more and more are choosing to take a gap year. And as we're looking in Milwaukee at the issues of ensuring that we have the workforce ready to fill the jobs that we have, that rising trend could be a bigger problem. And especially when we have COVID going on, we need to make sure we have something that brings people back. And there's going to be more and more instances of people maybe opting out or taking a gap year. And he came to us and said, let's do something together to solve this that can get people back on the path for their careers.
Yeah, one of the trends that in the last 10 years, people taking a gap year has risen 294%. Huge number, right? And how does a university build up a strategy to engage people, to address people taking that type of, if that's going to be a behavior shift in the population?
So Jeremy, it sounds like this is something that you were thinking about right around the time that the pandemic hit. How did the pandemic play into your thoughts on this? Because I mean, we might have not known at the time, but it does sound like there are more high school graduates who are foregoing college during the pandemic.
Yeah, and the pandemic is, you know, there was already a trend that people were enrolling less in university across the country, right? And as someone who never went to college and as someone who, you know, family couldn't afford it and didn't know what they want to do, I just didn't take a gap year. I took a gap life. But there's so many people out there that didn't have the opportunity that I had at the time to build a network. And that's kind of what led me down this path, is looking at the patterns and trends of where people are going, how they're interacting with university and where university will go in the future.
Laura, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to. So, you know, when students leave high school, they leave this organized system of career planning, and it becomes really completely on theirs to now figure out how to knit things together. And we, in doing all of our planning, realized it does not have to be that way. We can curate experiences and give exposure to students, introduce them to mentors, introduce them to our career hub here at MATC, where they can meet with career counselors. They can get exposed to a lot of different things. So we're going to expose a student to nursing and to automobile. We're going to, you know, expose them to manufacturing and IT. People have all different options, and sometimes figuring out with all the options that are there, what is the right path for them? And so in a 10-week period, we're going to give them an intense experience where they're able to see a lot of different things, have reflection, meet employers, be able to really talk to one another. So it really is to try to jumpstart that career planning, but do so in a fun, experiential way that's not, it's not as costly as starting in a class and not knowing if that's your route. And it certainly is something that gives them an opportunity to it's okay to take a step back and figure out what's next. In all the research that we look at, a degree is really, really important, whether it be a technical diploma, an associate degree, or bachelor's degree. The statistic is that 62% of jobs in Wisconsin will need a degree that's beyond high school. But as we stand here today in Milwaukee County, only 37% of our population has that degree beyond high school. And so when you hear about the skills gap and you hear about we have a gap between the jobs that are here and the workforce that is ready to work, that's what we're talking about. And so we have to throw multiple solutions at this challenge and give people the information they need to make career decisions. So the gap year is just another offering that we're bringing at MATC to the community.
So the MATC Gap Year program is starting in January 2022, and you're accepting applications right now. Can you talk more about the details of how the program is designed and what it's actually going to look like for the people who are involved in it?
How it's designed was be one day a week. So if, you know, a lot of what we found, and we did hundreds of listening or talked to hundreds of people in listening sessions. And what we found from the students to the guidance counselors, the parents, was that some newly high school graduates need to work. And so how do we build this around their schedule? And then how do we pay them for their time? So they're really, when they enter this program, they're not a student, they're really an intern, right? They're getting an experience, they're getting connections to employees, and they're getting a stipend. So the way it will be designed is week one, they'll get an immersive experience around Milwaukee, meeting civic leaders, you know, so future Mayor Johnson, they'll meet other city elected officials. Week two, the focus will be, you know, they'll spend half the day at MATC doing interactive labs, and then the next half of the day will be going to an actual employer. So we'll match an employer in that field to whatever that vertical is. So if that vertical is STEM, you know, we can go to a company like Northwestern Mutual and talk to their tech team and then try to build these mentors around them.
And the other piece of the puzzle is that each student is going to be doing a career assessment coming in that's based on it's something called the Holland Codes that really gets at what are they uniquely, like what's their natural disposition? Are they more of a creative person? Or they're like, and we're trying to get them to really think about matching their own passion, their just who they are as a person to the careers that are there. And they'll have one-on-one meetings with the career coaching team here at the college. And then if they're interested in turning that into an enrollment, let's say in summer or fall of next year, they're right on the path. So, you know, they start in January and they end in March, and then they can start planning of what their next move is for either the summer or fall. They might have just recently graduated and they're realizing, wow, I really got to kind of get my game plan together here. And so this gets them in the right position coming into 2022.
And, you know, the final thing I think of what the experience will be like will be around building a support structure around the individual, right? You know, one of the advantages to going to university in general is you build a network that can connect you to things. So we were really intentional about how can we design mentorships, how can we design connections, and how can we design an alumni strategy after this graduates so people can build it back and pay it back and be a part of this kind of ecosystem. So when you go through this program, you know there's people that you can count on after to help you connect you to that career or even go, you know, going to MATC.
And so what are some of the employers and careers that students will be learning about?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just give a rattle off a couple here is, you know, like in Doman, you know, was one of the big supporters of this when we first brought it to them. So there'll be a whole week dedicated to food as medicine, you know, as in sciences and all the other careers that work inside of, you know, food as medicine. What does that mean down to the, you know, how do you team that up with MATC's courses in this same field? One of the, you know, as we match these up, you realize that these are programs and things that MATC offers. So the creative arts, design, and media. So you'll spend the day at MATC working through all the possibilities in the creative arts and design and media, but then you'll go to Hoffman York and you'll get to meet people in the advertising agency and hear from executives there and see what a campaign would look like or how you could see yourself in that career. You know, same thing like business management, you think about Kohl's Corp or even the healthcare world, like Advocate Aurora, you know, doing a tour of St. Luke's, you know, seeing all the not just that you could have a career in healthcare, but all the different pathways in healthcare.
Can you Can you talk a little bit more about your target audience for this program?
Sure. As we were doing research on the experience of gap years, a lot of them are, you know, go to Costa Rica and hang out in the jungle for a year and go find yourself. And a lot of those are great. I would imagine that would be a pretty amazing experience. But a lot of them are really geared for individuals who could afford to take a year away and really be out of touch. And what we wanted to do is have something that is accessible to our population and people in Milwaukee who aren't really sure if they, one can, like a lot of the students that end up through our doors are folks that just felt like, I never even thought college was something accessible to me. In order to be accepted in the program, we want a family household income of under $75,000 a year. So we're intentionally targeting people that are middle, that are middle income, because it's just or lower income, because it's important to give people the opportunity to have access to this kind of program. We are having it be students that either graduated in 2020 or 2021, knowing that the pandemic kind of thwarted people's plans.
So this program, whether it was originally intended to be or not, is a program for high school graduates who graduated during the pandemic and have not decided to go to college yet. What are your hopes for what this accomplishes?
Yeah, I think if I could have the success of this program is about outcomes. If we have more people enrolling in university and more people getting careers at companies and more people building networks that can help them advance themselves, that's the ultimate goal here. And so if that happens, and we can actually monitor, you know, what percentage of these people over the next 5 years has done that. Is that 90% of people that run this program end up staying in the region, get a career in the pathway they wanted to, that could, have wealth transfer? That would be important, right? So I think the ongoing monitoring of what happens to each of these students from as they go through this program is kind of that's how I would measure it, of the success of it.
Jeremy Foyt is the Chief Ideas Officer at Milwaukee, and Laura Bray is the Vice President of Advancement at MATC. They spoke with WUWM education reporter Emily Files about the new MATC Gap Year program. Applications for the program are due October 31st. The pilot year of the program is capped at 25 participants, but the goal is to scale it up depending on demand. To learn more and how to apply, visit WUWM.com. Also at WUWM.com, if you add /give to that URL, it will take you to our donation site where we are relying on your support. This week is our fall member drive, and we're asking you to call 877-583-0309 or tap that red donate button on our app. You just heard from education reporter Emily Files. We feature her along with other news reporters on Lake Effect frequently because there's so much to cover, and with great resources like our news team, we want to share it with you. It's day 4 of the member drive, and you've been hearing from a lot of us on the air here on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Whether it's during Morning Edition or right now on Lake Effect, just like it's a team effort to put on a fun drive, it's also a community effort to continue supporting WUWM. So here's a word from one of my Lake Effect team members, Becky Mortensen.
Lake Effect is your connection to the community. I'm Lake Effect's executive producer, Becky Mortensen. If local programming, like what you hear on Lake Effect, is important to you, then give us a call or go online to make your contribution today. What you give will help us bring you all the programs you love on WUWM, like Lake Effect. The number to call is 877-583-0309. Or you can go online to wuwm.com/give.
We'll take one more break and then learn more about the new documentary, Finding Lauren, that's premiering this weekend at the Bradley Symphony Center. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. First Lieutenant Lauren Hintz of the Army Air Corps was based in Italy near the end of World War II. On April 21, 1945, his P-47 fighter bomber was shot down, and he was listed as missing in action until parts of the wreckage were found, and he was later declared dead. The late Milwaukee writer Martin Hintz, Lauren's son, was not yet born when his father died. We spoke with him in 2016 when they had recovered his father's plane 70 years after the crash in an Italian farm field. Martin Hintz passed in 2020, but his wife Pam Percy took it upon herself to produce and direct the documentary Martin was working to make a reality. Finding Lauren details the story of Lauren's life and the effort to find his plane and remains, and it will premiere this weekend at the Bradley Symphony Center. Ahead of that, Pam Percy joined me to share more about the documentary.
He hired a cinematographer to go to Italy. There were two trips. One was for the excavation, and the second one was for the big memorial celebration. So when he was in at the excavation and saw the beautiful footage that George Knoll had produced, that's when he decided that this had to be made into a movie. So he got home, he started writing grants, he started getting letters of support, he started the ball rolling, but unfortunately, when he passed away, the film really had not begun. So I was lucky to have all the archival information that his sister had, Gretchen Ronca. She had Lauren's diaries, his autobiography that he wrote when he was 18, and 350 letters that he wrote to Gert throughout the courting period and the war. So this was a huge body of work. And I read all 350 letters and the diary and everything. And then I compiled a timeline and then started using excerpts to create a script. So the first part of the movie is Lauren's life until he passed away or was killed when he was 27 years old. In those 27 years, he accomplished a lot. He was a poet. He was an actor. He wrote, he danced, he did storytelling. He traveled all over the country telling stories.
You mentioned going through all these archives and then trying to lay the foundation for a script of how you'd want to shape this story. What has been your filmmaking or documentary making experience before this? Or was it something that you just dove into?
I just dove into it. I have done other projects. I produced a radio show called Hotel Milwaukee, and I organized festivals and I've written a lot. Marty and I wrote a couple books together. So I had sort of the foundation, but I certainly have never made a film before. So I luckily was talking to a friend and said I was looking for an editor. And she suggested that I contact Bill Warner, who was a producer at Wisconsin Public Television. And he suggested Claudia Luz. So Claudia and I have been working on this film now for 9 months. And it was day in and day out, back and forth, emails, Zooms. I'd send her a script. She'd send me some footage. We'd discuss it. And it evolved. It was an exciting project to see this film come to being.
Well, and what's so great about the first part of the film is that most of it is in Lauren's own words, because you have all of these letters. Unfortunately, the letters he and his wife sent to each other during his basic training, Gertie's letters, weren't found. But there's such a plethora of things that gives you insight into this man. So what was it like for you to get a glimpse into who Lauren was through these documents?
I was just constantly amazed what a kind person he was. He reminded me so much of Marty. He even used some of the same expressions that Marty used, like the word kiddo. And Marty used the word kiddo a lot. And I know that Marty had not read his diaries, you know, for a very long time. So that DNA was pretty strong. You know, he loved life. He was enthusiastic. He was positive. He wanted to go serve his country. And he just kept plugging away and became a P-47 fighter pilot, which is quite a daunting task.
Your late husband, Marty, he never met his father. We should note to the audience that Lauren died in the plane crash before Marty was born. And one of Gertie's letters, Lauren's wife, to Lauren's parents says that, you know, he will be, quote, a good model to follow for the kids, even in death. So what do you believe the main characteristics were of Lauren that was passed down to his family?
Well, I think he was honorable. I didn't see a mean bone in his body. He was optimistic. He was artistic, and just a kind and generous person, I felt. And that certainly was passed along to Marty. All of the attributes of Lauren, Marty inherited. That DNA, as I said, is very strong.
You mentioned in 9 months you were able to get this documentary together, which was very impressive. I feel like documentaries most of the time are years long projects.
I know. Everyone is very surprised. We really pushed. Yeah, I was hoping to get it done by the year anniversary of Marty's death. And we made that goal. It was just completely finished just maybe a week ago. And it's beautiful. The music of John Seeger is fabulous. He's created amazing original music to go with the story.
This film, and it's both parts of its life, one in highlighting Lauren the man and then the effort to find his plane crash site, you know, it shows both the strength that he had and the courage and what he went through in life, but also shows how, you know, it's not always great to over-romanticize war and the many ways it impacts a lot of people. So what do you hope people take away from learning about your family and the story of Lauren Hintz?
The Hintz and the Ronca families became very close to the Italians that worked on this project. Their friendships were formed that will last forever. And the Italians are so grateful to the Americans for they saving them. They look at Lauren Hintz as a hero. There are special occasions in Italy, Lauren Hintz Day, and he's a very well-known figure in Italy. So I think the two worlds have come together and it's very moving.
So before we wrap this up, I was hoping you could read your husband's poem called Bones of My Father that's featured at the end of the documentary.
I'd love to. And in the documentary, it's read by Daniel Hintz, Marty's son. I touched the bones of my father, hard, unbreakable, and fearless. They still talk to me in long phrases, but not long enough because he is gone.
Well, and he's not totally gone. He lives through in this documentary.
He will live on in this film, and so will Marty. Marty is featured in this film. It's a story of Marty finding his father as well. There are a lot of stories that are going on in this. It's very touching, very moving.
It is a moving documentary. I can attest to that. And Pam, I want to thank you so much for sharing your insights with me and for the work you've done on this.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pam Percy is the producer and director of the documentary Finding Lauren, premiering Saturday afternoon at the Bradley Symphony Center. The event is free and open to the public, and you'll find more information, including COVID guidelines, at wuwm.com. While the first half of the documentary, Finding Lauren, focuses on the pilot and his life before he was killed in action, the second part is about how his family was able to successfully track down and excavate the crash site in Italy. Hans Ronca, the nephew of Martin Hintz and Lauren's grandson, was central in that effort. I spoke with him to find out more about what kind of work was involved in finding his grandfather's plane, both stateside and in Italy.
I still have that first email thread. Just because it's always something fun to recall and still stirs the emotion. Piero ended up contacting me and my mom, Gretchen, at about the same time because of that post that we had put up. And the reason Piero found us was he's a pilot, an aviation enthusiast. He's a flight instructor, and he's a member of a local flying club outside of Bologna. And one of his buddies, Marco Girotti, came in. And Marco had recently gotten his hands on a list of missing air crew reports and had already done some preliminary reduction of the information he was looking at and basically said, hey, look, based on kind of this general area, it looks like this guy, Lieutenant Hintz, went down not too far from here. And so there was a missing air crew report number. There was the name of the pilot, Piero and company, go plug that in. And then there, by typing in Lauren Hintz, they came across the post that my mom and I, and with the help of my grandma, had put up some 12 years before. And within a matter of days, he tracked me down and my mom down, including our email addresses, sent emails to both of us, introducing himself and explaining that basically the story I just told you, but in fewer words. And he said, if you're interested in finding where your grandfather was shot down and killed, I think I can help you.
That's pretty amazing. And there's this period between when Piero first contacts you in 2012 and then 4 years later, 2016 is when you were able to actually excavate the crash site. And I know probably so much goes into this, from getting permission from people who own the land, the Italian government. I'm sure the military estate side was involved in some way. So I'm just wondering, can you share some of the general, like, most important steps or partnerships that you made along the way that went into being able to connect all the dots and lead to your grandfather's crash site being excavated successfully?
Well, the most important step is to book a trip to Italy when a guy named Piero Fabbri reaches out to you and tells you you can find your grandfather. With some minimal vetting, we gained trust in Piero and a mutual long-distance electronic relationship form. So that was about February of 2012 when Piero first contacted us. By that summer, my wife came along to Italy with me, and at the time, our son, Augustus Lauren, he was 10. Now he's already off to college, so it's amazing how it passes. We made a great trip to Italy, met Piero, met that core group of people from his flying club, his confidants, if you will. And so I think there was a little bit of hedging bets on both sides. It's like, well, I don't know. What do we have to lose? Let's go to Italy. I don't think Piero's trying to defraud us. I think Piero was like, geez, I better start actually making, you know, producing some results here, which he did. So that first trip to Italy was huge. Piero had a pretty good idea of the lay of the land, the timing of incidents based on just sort of how the war really was winding down in the area. And he went to a small hamlet outside of Bologna, about 6 miles, met a number of locals, one of whom was a woman who was a little girl during the war. Her name is Teresa Bissonette. And she told Piero that, you know, people really aren't talking about the war around here still after all those years. But Piero's pretty persistent, and he's got a way of being able to talk himself into a lot of situations in a good way. And so she shared with him some information and suggested he might want to go speak to the owner of a large estate where she always had thought a rumor was that a plane had gone down. And so that was some of the key events there on that first trip that really got the ball rolling.
As you went from place to place, door-to-door interviews, kind of informally introducing yourself, getting to know various Italian families, you and them were impacted by the war, you know, specifically with your grandfather, but them on the other side living in a place that was a war zone. So in establishing these relationships, what has been the most fulfilling for you in making these personal connections that is sparked by you looking into where your grandfather crashed?
Oh, the relationships that we have with just an unbelievably large group of people in Italy, extremely generous people, very appreciative people, has been the absolute most rewarding part about this entire experience. Being able to share the experience with my mom, with my Uncle Martin, my cousins, my brother, our extended family has been incredibly enriching. And in the truest sense of the word, you know, we've got family on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean now. So by and large, the relationships that we have now that we will have for generations to come, I think really truly embodies the meaning and spirit of finding Lauren.
And there was an archaeologist group that helped excavate the site because it was a big endeavor. Was that group mostly volunteer-based?
Everybody that we've ever worked with as part of this project in Italy have been volunteers. And that just speaks to the appreciation that the people of Italy have for those who came, the Allied forces to really liberate Italy and free it from the evil and tyranny that had swept over it and had a grip on it for the better part of the 10 years leading up to the end of the war. And so it was all volunteer. The Archaeology dell'Aria is a volunteer group of enthusiasts who put the time and effort in to obtain proper permitting and set up to be able to go and do excavations. This was not their first excavation. Piero had started keeping track of them a few years before when, coincidentally enough, they recovered another pilot from the 79th Fighter Group. And so Piero helped facilitate those introductions. A lot of research had gone into verifying the location of the crash site before we brought the Archaeological Association in. And so that really was sort of at the very end of the whole discovery. Prior to that, there was a considerable amount of boots on the ground, knocking on doors that Piero did. And also after that first trip that my family and I had made to Italy in 2012, Piero kept pushing me to get more information from the American government, from the National Archives Records Administration, the Library of Congress, and some other agencies and institutions over here in the United States. Quite a bit of work was done that ultimately led to the big aha moment where we were quite confident we had located the right site.
In the documentary, you mentioned it's not just about discovering the plane. So what do you hope people think deeper about and what the wreckage represents?
Well, even before we, found Lauren, I've been very interested in preserving and honoring the legacy of the Greatest Generation is important, because if we forget the sacrifices that were made on the home front and on the war front across the board, almost every member of society, citizenry across this country came together, it does beg to question if we as a country right now have the fortitude to be able to put differences aside and rise to the occasion when we need to. So for me, the most important thing, and I say this a lot when I give talks and share my experience with groups, large and small, young and old, that it really is about honoring them and remembering the collective sacrifices that were made. And also about celebrating the triumph in times of darkness. While it was terrible that not only my grandfather Lauren was killed that day, one of the gentlemen who actually led us to the crash site's grandfather was killed not more than 100 yards away on that same day. So two families, a sea apart, drawn together because of a single occurrence at a moment in time, and learning about other people who had been killed in the village. So it really goes much deeper than just the actual finding of Lauren and his physical remains.
Hans Ranke is the grandson of Lauren Hintz. He led the recovery project to find the missing plane, which is featured in the new documentary, Finding Lauren. The film will premiere on Saturday. And before we wrap up today's show, I want to remind you that we are in our fall member drive, and we're asking you for your support. If you're listening right now, it means you're part of the WUWM community. And WUWM has been here to bring people together through the unique bond of public radio, inspiring Milwaukee with a world of diverse art and culture, offering an exceptional community focus, and that's driven by our commitment to meet the information needs of listeners like you. The mission of WUWM is to have independent reporting that serves you, not advertisers or shareholders or a bottom line. This station you know and trust is always relevant to the moment, to our great city, and to listeners wherever they reside. WUWM has always relied on member support for the great majority of funding. But in the new normal of 2021, our reliance on your generous support is greater than ever. So that's why your donation right now is so important to us. Please give now at wuwm.com/give. You can call 877-583-0309, or you can tap that red donate button on our WUWM app. We thank all of you who have taken the time to donate already, and for the rest of you who are waiting, take now as your sign to do so. WUWM.com/give or call 877-583-0309, and we thank you so much for your support. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Chase Browning and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver and Emily Files from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.